The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and by no means reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, suicide. A little more than a year ago, we talked with former Catholic priest Tom Smith about his book of essays, Church Chat, Snapshots of a Changing Catholic Church. Today, Tom and I turn our attention to a subject that frequently turns up in the news, a subject he knows about all too well, because in 2002, his 26-year-old daughter, Carla, who suffered from bipolar disorder, took her own life. Tom and his wife, Fran, have made it their mission ever since to prevent suicide by creating the Carla Smith Foundation. That's Carla with a K. Among Tom's books on the subject are The Tattered Tapestry, A Family Search for Peace with Bipolar Disorder, A Balanced Life, 9 Strategies for Coping with the Mental Health Problems of a Loved One, and most recently, The Unique Grief of Suicide, Questions and Hope. Back in a moment with Tom Smith.
This weekend, unplug. Getting closer to nature can get you closer to your family. To find the forest nearest you, go to discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome, Tom Smith. Welcome back.
I'm glad to be with you again, Maria.
Oh, my gosh. The last time we talked, it was about your book, Church Chat. What's the subtitle?
Snapshots of a Changing Church, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
and
right. Yeah, I enjoyed that with you, too.
Oh, I'm going to put a link, a fresh link, up on the website so that people can listen. It's you reflecting in short, easily accessible essays about your Vatican II era life as a priest and then a non-priest. Although, aren't you a priest forever or something?
Isn't well, it? 7 years. It only seemed like forever.
No, but I mean, can you not be, were you, what do they call it, laicized?
I was laicized, but the theology of priesthood sometimes says or stresses that you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.
Right, right. And, which I think we all, I mean, that's supposed to be all of us, right?
Well, that I think it does apply to all of us. In the formal sense, I don't quite subscribe to that approach, liturgical priests or ordained priests maintain that for the rest of their lives. I take more the position that a priest is functional. When you're not functioning that way, then I don't see the ontological change as being a significant way of thinking about it.
In any case, you were a priest, then you were not a priest, and you had a family, a tragedy in the family, which we're going to talk about today.
Sure. Yes, that's correct. And if you want, I'll outline that for you at this point.
That's good.
Yes. After I left priesthood, a couple years later, I got married to Fran, and we had twins, Kevin and Carla. And by the time the twins were 19 years old, Carla was in college, her second semester, and she pretty suddenly came down with what was later described as depression, clinical depression. 7 years later, and I'll jump forward, we can go back and pick up more of the story as we go, but 7 years later, after being diagnosed with bipolar disorder and having the ups and downs that go with that diagnosis, she, in a period shortly after being released from treatment for severe depression, she found a hidden .22 caliber rifle and shot herself and died by suicide. She was 26 years old. She was brilliant in many ways, beautiful, charming, very popular, and very interested in learning, very curious about the world, and focusing her particular talents were focused in more of the fine arts. Mm. She was an excellent, better writer than I am, and she so she was majoring in English literature at Oklahoma State University, just 3 credits away from graduating. Her college was delayed because of her illness for a couple of years, but she got stabilized, went back, 4.0 GPA.
Wow.
Had some good friends at that point. But she went into a deep depression right before Christmas, following a very manic time in her life. And then she took her life on January 13th, 2003.
Was that at school?
No, she was living in Tulsa at the time. She wasn't at Oklahoma State. She was taking some extension courses that were being offered in Tulsa, and she was living in a community home kind of place, a place where other people were, and she had like an apartment there.
Okay. So she was being treated successfully until she went into a tailspin. I mean,
yeah. What happened was that the year before, beginning of 2002, she had been on her meds and were taking them faithfully. But as I mentioned, she was a great writer. She was in the process of writing her memoirs, and we found this out later. She wanted to experience mania one more time.
No.
And she took herself off some of her meds. And as a result, some months later, you can't control that.
Yeah.
Some months later, she was in an extremely manic phase, which took her into the fall of 2002. Finally got her back on the meds and somewhat stable, but she very quickly cycled into a deep catatonic depression in December of 2002. And that's when Fran was with her in Tulsa over Christmas break, and she found her on New Year's Eve in kind of a catatonic state with a suicide note written. And got her into a treatment center in Tulsa, and they kept her there for 10 days. We were living at that point. We had moved back to my home area, which is in southern Illinois, Shiloh, Illinois. And Carla was still in Tulsa in this treatment center. And they released her against our wishes. But by that time, she was 26 years old. Mm. And they released her on a Friday with a very aggressive aftercare program beginning the following Monday at 3 o'clock, and talked to her on the phone that weekend, and she sounded okay, really. We were opposed to them releasing her. We told them that she needed more time.
Yeah.
But they released her, and she sounded okay. But that following Monday, she took her life.
Before the 3 o'clock beginning.
Around 1 o'clock.
So it's like she knew
There
was going to be some kind of attention paid, and she said, no.
I think what happened to her is that during the treatment time, she came to realize that she was going to have to deal with this situation for the rest of her life, and lost her hope that she was going to be able to keep struggling with it. And so she, I don't really call it a decision, Maria. They come to an accepting, I think, people who die by suicide come to accepting that this is the inevitable and hopeless way to end their pain. So it's a combination of that sense of feeling alone, being a burden to others, and hopelessness that it's not going to get better, that when she found the opportunity, she took it. But she knew she was going to take that opportunity, I think, earlier, which was why, in my theory, which was why that weekend she sounded okay. She was more at peace within herself because she saw her end coming.
It was like a relief.
That was her relief.
Wow.
And but she didn't see that she was going to get out of this cycle, even though she had three very successful years prior to that. So it's a complicated situation.
Right, and it's tempting to go into the weeds with, you know, defining terms, you know, for listeners who may wonder whether a loved one is bipolar, you know. I mean, what would a manic phase look like? Can maybe you can talk just briefly and then we'll press on. What are some symptoms of a manic phase?
Well, the way Carla described her mania, she we have some of her writings, and she told us this and it had written down. She said, imagine a switchboard where a light goes on when a call comes in. And you're looking at that switchboard, and a light goes on, and it's something about when you were in the third grade. 5 seconds later, another light goes on, and it's about the Mueller report. Another light goes on, and it's about sexual abuse in the church. And then another 5 seconds, a light goes on about a boyfriend she had previously. Her point is that different not related events keep coming at you every 5 seconds. And you're trying to process all of that in your head. A lot of people who have mania talk about racing thoughts. That's the way she described her racing thoughts. And they don't end. There were times when she could spend 3 days going through this process of pacing up and down. You know, at one point she spent a couple of days with her twin brother Kevin, and he was observed that similar kind of behavior. So that's mania. And
wait, just to clarify, he observed it in her.
Observed it in Carla.
He doesn't suffer from this.
No, he does not.
Wow.
He does not. Fortunately. But that's the kind of energy and light. But from Carla's perspective, you know, that sounds terrible, but that's a real high. And, you know, it's euphoric. And it's and they're capable of accomplishing all kinds of things.
And, you know, we are all on our phones and multitasking and, you know, it's kind of...
Yeah, you wonder if we're not in a manic society. And I think there are symptoms of that, which I think, just the flip side, maybe the attractiveness and the growing usefulness, if you will, of meditation, mindfulness... Spending quiet time, yoga, those kinds of things may be popular, more popular, in reaction to what is a manic society.
Lately, and it seems almost on a regular basis, a suicide or more than one suicide at a time shows up in the news.
Yeah, it does. And just to throw in some statistics here, Maria, we have the latest numbers from 2017, and 47,000, I think it's 173 suicides in the United States in that year. What that breaks down to is that there is a suicide in our country every 11.2 minutes.
Hmm.
There is a suicide attempt every minute.
Wow.
Worldwide, the World Health Organization estimates, some countries don't report very faithfully, but estimate over 1 million suicides a year. That's more than homicides, more than war.
Right.
So it is an epidemic kind of experience.
You are listening to a conversation with Tom Smith about suicide, why it happens, how to recognize the warning signs, and how to deal with the suicide of a loved one. Tom, a former Catholic priest, is the author most recently of The Unique Grief of Suicide, Questions and Hope. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Back in a moment with more.
What would happen if you didn't follow the established path? If you did the unexpected? Would you feel scared? Proud? Relieved? Could you explain that helping the people of Peru improve their own community would also have an effect on your own? Or assisting an entrepreneur in Ukraine to launch her small business? Or creating a support group in Malawi for children orphaned by AIDS? What if you established your own path? One that others might follow? Would you rather make your own way? Or spend your life saying, "What if?" Life is calling. How far will you go? Peace Corps. To find out more, call 1-800-424-8580. Or go to peacecorps.gov.
You know, that statistic, that last one from the World Health Organization, I made a note of it when I saw it in one of your books.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of precisely says that mental illness causes more deaths every year. But a question I have for you has to do with mental illness versus, or maybe is it the same as, suicides due to a trauma, you know, the Parkland tragedy, the Sandy Hook dad who finally couldn't bear it anymore, apparently. You know, that's,
yeah.
Would you lump that in with mental illness?
I would, and I do that not only on my perspective, but suicidologists who research this much more thoroughly than I do. The one I follow most closely is a guy by the name of Thomas Joyner.
Mm-hmm.
He's from Florida State University, whose father died by suicide when he was studying in college in psychology. And so he has devoted his career to asking that question of why people die by suicide. And he pretty well nails it down, I think. And most other suicidologists would agree, too, that it is a mental illness. Some mental illnesses are fatal.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they die is through suicide.
Right.
So I put the two together. There are obviously circumstantial situations, like you mentioned, the school shootings and other trauma situations, that put some people into a circumstance whereby it's hard for them to cope with their life. But coupled with that, I think they would all suggest, these suicidologists would suggest, that there's an internal reaction going on too, which amounts to, under the general category of a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
So that the way we say it in our support group for people whose loved one died by suicide, it is that no one dies by suicide who is in their right mind.
Right.
That's our way of trying to convey that thought. But yeah, I do link the two very closely together.
Okay. I'm thinking of Spalding Gray, the monologuist who took his own life. He suffered from depression anyway, I think, but finally he had a terrible car wreck that physically mangled him.
Okay.
To the point where I don't think he felt like himself. You know, they repaired him as best as they could, but I think what he did was he threw himself off the back of the Staten Island Ferry. And you know, he was a brilliant, brilliant, famous person, well-loved, and talk about, you know, a creative mind, a wonderful writer. And his mother, interestingly, his mother had killed herself. So, you know, like you say, it's complicated. You know, there could be perhaps genetic.
Well, there is some genetic connections. If there is a suicide in your family, the risk of another suicide goes up.
Hmm.
I mean, it's not like a predetermined thing.
Right.
But the risk factor increases.
The word despair comes up in your book. And it brings to mind what the Catholic Church holds about suicide. I wonder if it still does or if it's now, you know, defunct. This idea that despairing is a sin.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, talk about blaming the victim.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's not as bad as it used to be. If you would check the Catholic Catechism, the official catechism, which I did, the wording in there now about suicide does still mention despair, but it immediately adds that there could be psychological factors that minimize the guilt attributed to it.
Okay.
So it's a little, so it doesn't read the way I would like for it to read, but it is better than it used to be, and certainly better than what the practice was of not even allowing a Catholic funeral.
Right.
For someone who died by suicide.
Carla had a Catholic funeral. It sounds like you had a beautiful priest.
Well, we did.
We did.
And our pastor was very compassionate and a good friend of mine who was in a seminary with me. And I also have to tip my hat to Bishop Wilton Gregory, who was our bishop at the time here and who was my boss, who I worked for, and who was just recently been selected as the new Archbishop of Washington.
I was wondering if that was the same Gregory. Wow.
Same guy. And he...
You have friends in high places, Tom.
Well, yeah. But he is a very compassionate, understanding, pastoral person. For example, the day of her funeral, I was on staff at the time for the diocese, and we were supposed to have a diocesan pastoral council meeting that day.
Yeah.
I was the staff resource person for that pastoral council that Bishop Gregory, you know, attended and led. But he canceled the whole meeting and came to the funeral.
Wow.
And he has been supportive of our organization as well,
financially.
Our Carla Smith Foundation, Carla Smith Behavioral Health, which we have created in not just in memory of Carla, but to try to help families and friends and people who are dealing with mental health issues and anyone who lost a loved one to suicide.
And I'll post that address on my reasonablycatholic.com site for listeners who may want to Google it up as they're listening. It's Carla with a K.
That's right, yes.
Yeah. You know, as much as we just, you know, threw some bouquets toward the clerics who led and attended the funeral, it seems that not all of the attendees were, what shall we say, too compassionate, because you overheard and or got notes from people who essentially said Carla was responsible for her own death.
Yeah, there were some comments like that. It showed up after the funeral, mainly.
Okay.
Where people were extending some of their condolences, but, you know, we knew how, the way they said it, and some of the words that they used, that yes, the guilt was on Carla, and I even had one tell me it was a shame to have my daughter in hell.
Stop.
No.
Oh, God.
That was one.
Oh, my God.
But we did get some of that kind of feedback. And you know what? I'm sad to report that in our suicide support group, helping people who lost a loved one to suicide, a good number of people over these 13 years that we've been doing this have mentioned similar things. We often have to deal with how other people react to this a suicide in the family.
Yeah, on top of everything, you know?
On top of everything else, that's right.
Wow.
Right. But many people, let me. I don't want to paint that picture too darkly.
Yeah.
Because many people, frankly, don't know what to say.
Yes, right.
You know, when you say your daughter dies by suicide, or your husband, or whomever, that is a conversation stopper, usually.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I've learned to cope with that over the years. But when people are new to this experience of grieving a suicide, they will probably run into that.
Yeah, but that hell comment, there's no category for that. You know?
Oh, there is no category. I think, the inferno is me.
Oh.
Has a special place.
Really? Exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I saw a headline. It was about really young kids being brought to emergency rooms because they're threatening suicide.
Yes.
Is that something that's crossed your radar?
Oh, yeah. We are aware of that. In fact, we had a 10-year-old take his life in our area within the last number of months.
Oh, no.
10-year-old. It's incredible. So it's and that is unfortunately it's increasing more, and they're getting younger.
What the heck?
Yeah.
How should we understand that?
Well, I think there's just a lot of stresses and a lot of our contact through social media and television and stuff like that to events in the world are, I think, a context in which that takes place. So even young kids hear about it, like you see in the news.
Mm-hmm.
If that implants an idea and they start feeling very depressed themselves and take that opportunity of doing it.
Oh, they're poor parents.
Yeah. And they get a lot of focus, you know. But just to be accurate, the majority of suicides are really white males between 34 and 65.
Interesting.
That's the most of any demographic group who take their lives are men in that situation.
Is it typically by gunshot?
Over 50% by about closer to 55-60%.
Wow.
Who use firearms as their method, and all the other methods are divided up among the other 40-50% of how people die.
Mm-hmm.
And most men die by suicide by firearms. Unfortunately, women using firearms, that is increasing also. And the problem with using a firearm as opposed to other methods, even attempted hanging or poison or pills, is that firearms are usually effective on the first attempt. Other methods are not as effective.
Mm-hmm.
So people survive suicide attempts.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about suicide today with Tom Smith, whose daughter Carla suffered from bipolar disorder and took her own life when she was just 26. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU.
88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts, stoprex.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
So does this issue of gun control dovetail with your mission?
It certainly does to me. Yeah. I think we just need to control more guns.
Right.
Because if you look at the statistics again, people dying by firearms, more of them die by suicide than die by homicide.
Right.
Or die by, you know, public mass shootings. So... And those guns are guns in private homes where they are easily accessible to someone who is in depression and feeling alone, feeling like they're a burden, and they use a gun that's convenient to them.
Right.
So, yes, I personally would like to see more gun control, but most of that conversation, Maria, is about semi-automatic guns and bump stocks and multiple magazines, which all deal with mass shootings.
Right. It's a different thing.
Suicide firearms are usually a single-shot gun.
Yeah.
And we focus here on suicide prevention. I'm part of a county-wide Suicide Prevention Alliance, and we've been trying to do some education and that to the public. And one of the things we clearly say about firearms, if someone's going to have them in their home, is to lock them up, keep the ammunition at a different place than where the guns are, no easy access to young people in particular, keep them away. You know, just...
But a really determined suicidal person is going to find a way. Is it not the case?
Well, yes and no to that. Yes, in the sense that Carla had attempted suicide 3 other times.
Oh.
By pills.
Okay.
And fortunately, her roommate found her after she took a massive overdose one time and got her to the hospital. We found her, or she called us the first time. So she had her preferred way of dying was through pills.
Mm-hmm.
But what the statistics show is that a person intent on taking their life also has a preferred way of doing that.
Okay.
And that if you keep the person away from a gun and they can't have access to a gun at the time when they are particularly suicidal, then that person will normally not choose another way to kill himself, jump off a bridge.
Wow.
And they know this, again, by talking to people who attempted suicide.
Do they attempt again and again?
Some people do.
Uh-huh.
Some people, but some do not.
Right.
So if you are able to intervene in a person's suicidal attempt, if you are able to stop that, they may never be suicidal again.
Hmm.
And that's the basis for our suicide education program that we're doing locally, which is also a national program, which is called QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer.
Wow.
And what we've found is that many people, when they're in a conversation with someone who is, you know, I don't know if you've ever been there, but some people get there. You know, you're talking to a friend or a family member or somebody, and you begin to think, I wonder if this person's suicidal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're They're so unhappy.
Yes.
You know, they're so, everything seems so wrong. And I'm beginning to think that they might be suicidal. You know what most people do?
What?
They change the topic.
Oh.
They're afraid to ask the question, are you suicidal?
Yeah.
And they're afraid to ask it because if they say yes, then it goes back to the questioner and say, what do I do now? How do I handle this?
Right.
And they don't want to deal with that. How do I handle it if I ask them and they say, yes, they are?
Yeah, right.
So that scares people away. So
what we're trying
to do in our education program here is to encourage people to ask the question and then persuade them to get help and then refer them either to a counselor, a hospital, or emergency room, or the suicide hotline, which, you know, is another way of trying to have something handy that you can use at any time in order to help someone maybe get through it. And I can give you that number if you want it.
Absolutely.
Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255.
Okay.
And there's always somebody there. That's 24 hours, 365 days a year. And for the younger crowd in particular, if they want to do a text, if they're feeling suicidal or somebody's suicidal, the text number is 741-741.
Okay. Helpful. Very good.
Yeah.
You know, I have a couple of personal anecdotes apropos of what you were talking about, and I'll share them with you. And one is that back in my newspaper reporter days, I don't know, just, you know, talking idiotically, I think I said, I'm going to kill myself.
Okay.
My editor, very sweet guy, I think he must have had some training where they told him never just, you know, dismiss such things.
That's what we say too.
Right? And he looked at me very meaningfully and said, are you considering suicide? I'm laughing because no. I was just being glib, and for him to actually wonder about it just struck me as insane. It's like, I mean, anyone could look at me and see I'm not suicidal. Or maybe that's not even true. I mean, are there cheerful people who end up killing?
Oh, God. That's why we suggest ask the question. Because it's better to have your reaction than it is for someone who might just flippantly say that but be very serious about it.
Right. Better to ask, you know.
And if they had, I just did a training, today's Friday, on Wednesday, with another person from here on precise suicide prevention in Springfield, Illinois, and that question came up there, and we made very sure to tell them that, yes, ask the question, and Error. If you make the mistake on that side.
So the other anecdote is about how I was one of those people who dropped the ball because also in my newspaper life, I was working in a bureau of the paper, and the manager of the bureau, you know, he had an Ivy League education, but he had been terribly mistreated from his point of view and demoted. So now he was in this backwater office of the paper. He used to be kind of a big wheel, and he was clearly sad, you know, and he would mope around the office. And at one point he took the cord from the Venetian blinds and he was wrapping it around his neck and unwrapping it and just kind of being all forlorn. And one day when he wasn't in the office, I said to a coworker, I said, gosh, you don't suppose he's going to kill himself? And this fellow reporter, Southern gal, because he was a terrible boss, you know?
No.
She said, Maria, he ain't gonna hurt nobody but us.
Yes.
And, you know, sure enough, he didn't die that way. He ultimately did die quite young, but it was of an illness. Oh. And, wow. You know, now, listening to you, I'm thinking I should probably have pursued that, you know, in a more serious fashion.
Well, let me spell that out a little more in detail.
Okay, yeah.
And these are the findings of Joyner,
okay.
In which I buy.
All right.
Three characteristics that you want to look for in someone who may be suicidal. One is that they feel alone.
Mm-hmm.
That they're not alone, and Carla fits this description too, that the Christmas before she died, she was at home visiting us here, and she was very, very despondent, and we talked to her, and she told us that everything that inside of her was telling her to kill herself.
Oh.
And she wasn't worth the chemicals that made up her body.
Oh.
So we assured her that we were there for her, that we will work through this together, and we loved her. And I tried to hug her, and I don't know. Have you ever hugged somebody and never got anything back?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way she... And she is a very affectionate, feeling
yeah.
person. You know,
okay.
A normal hug with Carla was wonderful. But this was a cold
yeah.
hug.
Wow.
And it was like... She was saying, I know what you want to do, Dad, but it's not getting through. And that's feeling alone.
Yeah.
So the first, and you know, 3 weeks later, she was dead.
Oh.
So the first thing you want to look for is if someone feels alone.
Yeah.
The second thing you want to look for is if they feel like they are the burden on others.
Yeah.
Not that other people are a burden on them.
Right.
But they're the burden.
Yeah.
And you couple those two with a third characteristic, which is they have acquired the ability to inflict self-injury.
Hmm.
What that means is that they have a personality that has been exposed to or is responsive to violence, a lot of violence in their life, some professions. Law enforcement people have
yeah.
a higher rate of suicide than others. Psychiatrists are a high rate of suicide, too.
You know what I read recently, just preparing for our talk today? Veterinarians.
Veterinarians. Okay, okay. And you know who else?
Who else?
Farmers.
Wow.
And that characteristic can also be kind of a personality trait. If you know someone who likes to ride a motorcycle without a helmet 90 miles an hour
mm-hmm.
down a country road, you know, kind of risky behavior,
that all
those things, suicide attempts, alcoholism, drug abuse, all those kinds of things kind of feed into this third characteristic that they say. So if you put together feeling alone, being a burden on others, and having this acquired ability to inflict self-injury, if they all coincide, then you're looking at
a ticking time bomb.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
This is a conversation about suicide with Tom Smith, whose daughter Carla took her own life at age 26. Suicide takes more lives than homicide and war, according to the World Health Organization. If you or someone you know is at risk of committing suicide, there's a 24-hour hotline you can call. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. This is Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, providing community radio that matters. Although, you know, I'm thinking young adolescent boys, you know, they take risks and they, you know, and the girls are moody. And I mean,
yep.
Is there a higher incidence of suicide among teenagers?
Well, it's the the state of Illinois and nationwide, it's the third cause of death for people in that age group.
Goodness.
Accidents are always number one.
Okay.
And some accidents are suspiciously suicidal.
Ah.
And then number two and three kind of reverse at different times. One is homicide and one is suicide. Currently, it's suicide is a number two way in which kids in that age, including college, that's how they die. So that's prevalent among that age group.
Hmm.
But like I said before, the numbers of people in that age group who take their lives don't add up to the same numbers of people, of white males between 35 and 65 who take their lives.
Hmm.
So, and that demographic is the upper end of that middle age. It had more suicides than the lower end of that. Anyway, I think in those cases, when you put those three things together, the feeling alone, the burdensome, and the weight and the self-injury, I don't know if your editor guy would fit that category.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when you said it, did he feel like he was the burden?
I don't think so.
No, but other people were the burden on him.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That's why I would guess that suicide was not the way he died.
Right. And that he wasn't going to hurt anyone but us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Oh,
probably
my God.
Enjoy it.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, God rest his soul.
Yeah.
Well, I really want to salute you. I know that you have a very deeply personal reason for being on this mission, but
yeah.
It can't be easy to deal with daily.
Yeah, that is the downside of it. Many people who grieve a suicide, if they do grief work and in time, they get to a point that I call assimilation, which means that they don't deny the experience and they don't forget it. But assimilation, I think, is better than acceptance. Assimilation means that they have absorbed that terrible experience into their life, but they are able to experience other things without it being related to the suicide.
Oh, good.
The first couple of years after a suicide, it's like you're looking through those glasses at everything.
Yeah.
And you don't think you're ever going to smile again.
Right.
But with grief work and with time, you can get through those things.
And what is grief work? Is that like therapy?
It's a form of therapy. Grief work means this. It means identifying the feelings correctly that you're having.
Yeah.
And coping with them.
Okay.
That's grief work. And there's a lot of intense feelings that come with suicide grief. More intense than with other forms of death. I mean, my parents have died. I had a sister who died by cancer way too young, a brother who died too young. So I know grief.
Right.
But Carla's grief is more intense because, and it's got a jumble of a lot of emotions, including guilt, regret, things like I coulda, shoulda, woulda.
Mm.
Why didn't I pick up the signs? What should I have done? Like for me, it's why didn't I go back to Tulsa that weekend that she was released from this treatment center and spend that weekend with her? Why did I stay in Illinois? Why didn't I get in the car and just drive down there and spend that weekend with her? That's my biggest regret. My anger, a lot of people are very angry about these deaths too.
Yeah, sure.
And sometimes that anger is diffused, but sometimes it's very specific. They get angry at the person who took their life. They get angry at God. They get angry at doctors. They get angry at, mine was directed more towards the treatment center that released her too early.
Sure.
But there's an anger there that is an unusual and intense anger that most people have not experienced in their life.
Wow.
But they experience that, they experience the shame, they experience the loss, of course, and guilt. So all of the problem with suicide grief is that all of those are happen all at the same time.
Wow.
And it's hard to pull them apart. And so what I mean by grief work is being able to identify those accurately and coping with them, dealing with them,
yeah.
getting through them.
Right.
Not ignoring them.
Right, right.
And many people try to ignore them. And if you get through it, then you can come to what I call assimilation. And I think that's the journey. And that's the journey that we try to lead people through or help them through in our support group. And my wife, Fran, is a mentor. She was a counselor at one time, but hadn't kept up all her certification in that. But so she's now a mentor. But she meets people one-on-one also.
Wow. Bless her heart.
To get through this and other issues, too. But getting through that grief is very difficult.
With our remaining minute or two, let me ask whether your faith sustains you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I am convinced that without my faith, without my belief in my kind of God, and without my faith community, I would be much, much further behind mm-hmm. in this journey. I would not have arrived at assimilation.
Wow.
It is absolutely critical to me. I pray, Fran and I pray together and meditate. I have a small faith community that I participate in. My work through our foundation, our behavioral health organization, helps me reach out to other people in need, which I think is an essential part of faith. So there's a lot of dimensions to my life that are wrapped up in my faith.
Yeah.
And it's still a Catholic faith at this point.
Yeah.
I am sometimes tempted to drift away from that, but I remain a practicing Catholic because of some of those experience and ties that I have to my local community and to... What the church does institutionally in terms of hospitals, schools, helping organizations around the world, I relate and identify with that as well. So yes, that's kind of an involved but longer answer to your question.
Oh, that's excellent. And you and I are going to talk again about some of those issues with the institutional church. It'll
okay,
have to wait till another day, but I want to thank you so much, Tom Smith. Really, it's just always so helpful to talk to you, and I wish we lived nearer each other.
Yeah, I do too, Maria. I enjoy talking with you, and I applaud you and the work that you're doing through your program, Reasonably Catholic. I look at your ongoing conversations, and you're doing a marvelous mission. By making that available to people. So I compliment you on that.
Well, mutual admiration.
Yes.
Let's keep in touch.
Let's do that.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Maria.
Bye-bye. That was a visit with Tom Smith, author of several books about suicide, most recently, The Unique Grief of Suicide, Questions and Hope. You can learn more from the foundation that Tom and his wife Fran created by going to carlasmithfoundation.org. That's Carla with a K. If you missed any of this episode or want to share it with friends, I'll post it later this evening at reasonablycatholic.com. I'm Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Wonderland with DJ Cheshire Cat.